Okay, I think we can start. Thank you, everybody, for coming to yet another of the Hellenic Observatory seminars this term. It is a great pleasure to welcome Alexander Kritikelenis today to give a presentation for today's seminar on the newly disadvantaged in Greece, and a topic which is of much interest definitely to Greeks, but I think to all people looking at European matters and how they relate to the events of the last few years in terms of austerity politics and the Eurozone crisis. Alex is a research associate at the University of Cambridge, affiliated to the to King's College in Cambridge and the Department of Sociology. He has a PhD, an MPhil in Development Studies at the University of Cambridge, and previously studied at the University of Athens. He's a political sociologist or political scientist, and working also on development studies, development issues. But I think he's perhaps known to many people for the work he's done with other colleagues on the social and economic and health impacts of the crisis in Greece. He published some work on that on the Lancet, and also has published in journals like the European Journal of Public Health. And others. He will talk to us, as I said, today on the newly disadvantaged, but before we go on to the presentation, because I always forget, so I will announce now two important events that we have. One, just tomorrow, we have the Metropolitan Ignatius of Demetrias and Almiros, who is giving a lecture tomorrow at 6:30 in the Hong Kong Theatre here at LSE on the Greek Orthodox Church and the economic crisis, so yet another take on the economic crisis in Greece. You're all welcome there. I think this is a first-come, first-served basis, so you're all welcome tomorrow 6:30 at the Hong Kong Theatre at LSE. And we resume the series, the seminar series of the Hellenic Observatory in 2 weeks' time with a presentation by Dr. Effie Fokas. That's a very long title, on the relationship between religion and national identity from the perspective of religious minorities in Greece. So all welcome again on the 25th of November here in 2 weeks' time. I will then pass the floor to Alexis, who will talk to us about his research on the newly disadvantaged in Greece.
Great. Well, many thanks to Vasilis and the Observatory for inviting me. So today I'm going to talk about responses to the crisis in Greece. I'm quickly going to go through the background of the Greek crisis and then discuss a little bit the relationship between the Greek crisis and the welfare state. Then the main part of my presentation will be on responses to the crisis by a very much affected community in Athens. And then I'll wrap up with implications of my work both for Greece and other southern European countries. So to start with, the Greek crisis, the first year of recession was 2008, but the crisis in most people's eyes really starts around 2010, especially mid-2010 when the bailout was agreed. Greece was bailed out by the so-called Troika, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the IMF combined. Here's George Papandreou, then Prime Minister, in an island right in the corner of Greece, announcing that we would be bailed out. And as part of that bailout, a range of austerity conditions and other reforms were introduced. So the strategy opted into by Greece was one of internal devaluation, which meant that a reduction in the level of prices would be brought about by rapid and extensive cuts to public spending, a reorganization of the labor market, and increases in public revenues, including via taxation and the privatization or marketization of welfare services. So within 6 years, there was about a 23% decline in GDP, which in turn had knock-on effects on the political system. Here you see, the colors don't come out very well, but here you see basically the fragmentation of politics following the crisis. So as you can see, the two old parties, big old parties, New Democracy and PASOK, combined up until 2009, managed to command about 80% of the vote. and then they collapse electorally around 2012. And you can see there with the dark red the rapid rise of Syriza, which is a radical left party, Golden Dawn, which is this black box over here, and some other new parties. So, in the aftermath of the bailout, a range of social consequences can already be seen. Sadly, these consequences are too many to enumerate, whether it is population at risk of poverty or people with severe material deprivation, child poverty rate. UNICEF published a report a week ago or so documenting a near doubling of the child poverty rate in just a few years. So I'm not going to go in depth into all of this. I'm just going to show you the unemployment rate, where within just a few years, Greece's unemployment rate went up to 27.5%, with a long-term unemployment rate, which is a red line, following closely. So looking at how the welfare state has coped, there are a few narratives. One is that the crisis was a consequence of welfare, of the profligate Greek welfare state. Now, that's not very accurate, in the sense that Greece was not spending more than other countries in the Eurozone. However, if we look at the composition of spending rather than the absolute value of spending, we see a Greek welfare state that was inefficient and that was actually spending in the wrong things. So despite increases in spending, we never really saw that being translated into inequality reduction or poverty reduction or any of those things. To the contrary, actually, groups that were already benefited were the beneficiaries of the extra spending, whereas vulnerable groups had little resources transferred to them. And in many ways, the Greek welfare system is very similar to that of other southern European countries, by which I mean there are protective employment regulations for those in the public sector and large industries, and that's joined with job instability for those in other sectors of the economy. There are quite weak social safety nets and, surprisingly, a universalist health system. So I will touch upon two policies that received a lot of attention by the Troika in the bailouts. First, labour market policy. The objective was really to introduce labour market flexibility, including by the reduction of public sector employment and changing the employment protection regulation. And at the same time, despite the crisis, welfare state regulations were not updated to take into account the new social reality. So in this chart, I have in the red, with the red line the number of unemployed people, which, as you can see, around 2013, reach 1.4 million, close to 1.4. And the green line down there is those receiving benefits. So we really see that even though around 2010, 36% of the unemployed people were receiving unemployment benefits, by 2013, only 12% of the unemployed were receiving any kind of benefits. And actually, the people here in this part are the people I'm mostly interested in for this presentation and on which I will talk about shortly. So turning to health policy reforms, health spending was capped at 6% of GDP as part of the bailout, a figure that was rather arbitrary. Nobody has managed to give me a good explanation why 6% and not 6.2 or 6.5 or 5.8 for that matter. And today Greece actually has one of the lowest health spendings as a share of GDP among the Eurozone countries. So a number of reforms excluded people from the health system and shifted costs to patients. In research I did with colleagues analyzing the EU statistics on income and living conditions, we found a 47% rise in people reporting unmet medical need, reporting that they needed to go see a doctor and they couldn't. And that was linked to the inability to afford care or the cost of travel. So, and much of my work has been on these issues. But if I'm a bit unfair to my past work, I would say that it really sets out to study vulnerable groups and finds that they are indeed vulnerable. So in a way, the research ends where it should begin. As a sociologist, I am very much interested in how people respond to the crisis rather than merely tracing some effects of the crisis. So in this presentation, I really want to move beyond the diagnosis of the problem and examine how people experience socioeconomic change and how they maintain a livelihood in the face of adversity. Now, as a sociologist, these kind of questions, going back to Durkheim, are really foundational in the discipline. And much research on such issues in Europe really focuses on the role of the welfare state in helping people cope and in helping people re-enter the labor market and end their spells of unemployment. However, if we look at the case of Greece after the crisis, an already underdeveloped welfare state cut service provision even further. So these cuts really disproportionately affected those who were already in a precarious situation. As I will discuss in a bit, an increasing share of the population receives neither earnings from work nor welfare benefits. And it is these people I'm interested in this study. So with these issues in mind, I went to Perama, which is here in the red box. It's a neighborhood in Athens, close to the port of Piraeus here, which is Greece's largest port. And the main employers there include the port authority, shipping companies, oil refineries, and small businesses catering to these industries. The area was first inhabited in 1922 after the Greek-Turkish War by refugees, and then witnessed a wave of internal migration in subsequent decades as people were looking for low-cost housing close to the port. Now, in fact, this is a neighborhood, and here you can see some of the shipyards. So, in fact, the internal migration meant that a lot of people actually appropriated land and built humble dwellings that over time they transformed into proper houses. And after several decades of struggle, they managed to get property rights granted to them by the 1970s. And population in this neighborhood, in this area, has been about 25,000 and quite stable since the 1980s. Now, according to my interviews with the town hall authorities, unemployment in the area is around 55%. But I don't have data on how it breaks down by age, given that the municipality didn't have that data. But it is one of the areas most affected by the crisis. And it is a leftist area primarily. In the left column, you have the 2009 data on how people voted. You can see that 44% voted for PASOK, the Social Democratic Party, and almost 13% for the communists, and smaller numbers for the other parties. And then moving on to 2012, the next elections, you can see a large displacement of voters from other parties who moved to Syriza at 36.3%, which is about 10 points higher than the national average. You can see a lot of people moving to Golden Dawn from 0.5 to 9.4. And you can see actually that many people abandoned PASOK. So it went from 44% to just 8%, below even the national average for the party. So in this neighborhood, I went with the objective of examining the responses of working class people who were deeply affected by the crisis. Now, how do we define deeply affected? In the context of overall economic hardship, it's quite difficult to decide who fits that criterion, in the sense that the sole breadwinner in a family of four with two underage kids, whose salary has been cut by 25 or 30%, is arguably in a dire situation. And yet, given that in Greece, a lot of the welfare services are linked to employment status, that person would still have some kind of welfare services, would be eligible. So in my study, I take employment status as a proxy. And I had three criteria for selecting interviewees. It was Greek citizenship, the loss of employment since the onset of the crisis, and haven't been unemployed for 2+ years, because that would make them ineligible to access any kind of welfare services. So I really argue that this group has been among the most affected. Their standard of living has deteriorated, their social status has declined, and the symbolic construction underpinning their identity has been threatened. In total, I conducted 32 interviews. Occupationally, my interviewees had blue-collar jobs or were self-employed in low-status jobs. The youngest was 29 years old, and the oldest was 64. I also had 2 focus groups discussions, but overall, given that I spent 5 months in the area, the interactions informing my analysis are considerably more. And the quotes I will present here were chosen for representativeness. So, as you can tell probably from my criteria, some groups were excluded from my study. Those who were poor or unemployed before the crisis, youth, pensioners, and immigrants. I can discuss this in the Q&A section, but in my view, these groups have been affected by the crisis, but in a rather different way than my interviewees. And also, there is a bias in my sample selection, insofar as I could not undertake fieldwork in the local chapter of Golden Dawn, and I will return to that shortly. So, in short, I find that the 3 pillars of welfare provision have been very much affected. The market was not able to absorb the large number of unemployed people, thus diminishing people's material resources. The welfare state not only failed to keep up with rising demand for its services, but actually in several instances actively harmed the people who depended on it the most. The family, traditionally a so-called social shock absorber in Southern Europe, was limited in its capacity to cope with the new conditions, as households with no earners became more prevalent. So as a response to these dynamics, new dynamics emerged that I group under 3 headings. First, non-state actors stepped in to provide elementary welfare services. Second, the social landscape became reconfigured in response to disintegration in the community. And finally, new cultural repertoires started to be constructed. As people's skills were no longer validated by the market, they turned to these repertoires to regain a sense of worth and belonging. So these are really ongoing and parallel processes, and I will discuss each in turn. So the first key shift in my field site refers to the emergence of non-state actors to provide basic services to the population. For example, a large global charity established a primary care practice in the neighborhood in 2011 that's completely staffed by volunteer doctors and nurses, and that is referred to as a social clinic. But they also provide basic necessities like food or medicines, diapers, milk for infants, that sort of thing. Eligibility criteria are rather strict. People have to prove that they cannot access public welfare services, and they get a box of food every month or so, depending on availability, that contains rice, pasta, canned tomatoes, and some cooking oil. Now, the church also provides some services to the area, primarily food, in the form of soup kitchens. So these developments are quite new to the area. Prior to the crisis, there was no local demand for such services, and eligibility for public services and the ability to afford food was not really in question. Yet still, while this practice was very much appreciated, it was the case that it was not a space for socialization, where people could build links to each other and form the kind of bonds that would enable them at a later stage to draw on each other for day-to-day challenges. And neither did such organizations aspire to be such integration mechanisms. My first experience there was encountering a woman in her 50s who was crying. She was brought in by her son, And a friend of hers lived opposite this social clinic. And this woman thought she saw her friend in the balcony opposite the clinic. And she was too ashamed to go out because of what her friend would think of her now that she had to go to a social clinic. And in tears, she was explaining this to the staff who were trying to console her. And such an incident was not really unique. Resorting to this kind of social clinic for the first time was generally described in terms of necessity and embarrassment in most of my conversations. For example, Christos, who had a small corner shop selling newspapers and cigarettes in the neighborhood, put it like this. Coming here was really hard in the beginning. My friend Kostas recommended that I come, so that they help me get my medicine. I need to take some drugs that cost 51 euros per month, and I cannot ask my brother or friends to give me the money. They're really hard-pressed too. Of course, I still carry the remains of a former life. I mean, dressing properly, wearing a suit, wearing a tie, looking respectable. So the day I saw Kostas at the bus stop, I was wearing my suit, and Kostas said, "Don't go there to the social clinic like this. Go a bit more in rags." I laughed and didn't think more about it. But when my drugs ran out and I had no money to get some, I came. I saw the GP, and he said that I should also see the psychologist. This sounded weird to me. Okay, I'm not at this point. I mean, when I'm alone sometimes, I understand there's no way out of my situation, and I reach this dead end sometimes. But I try to survive like this. The first time I came here, I welled up. I said to the staff, "Don't look at me in a suit like this. My friend told me not to come here like this. But if I got turned away, I wanted to leave clean, with dignity. I mean, I didn't want to go there with this old jacket that I have, so they would take pity on me. They should look inside me, not the outside." These feelings of shame associated with visiting the clinic for the first time can be understood in relationship to the former status of these people as being able to enjoy a full range of welfare services. The issue for them had really become one of survival. From the perspective of my interviewees, all of whom until the onset of the crisis paid social insurance contributions, the state was now reneging on a central promise to them. Reliance on charity was experienced as a shameful loss of independence. Thus, while such basic services did provide some means of subsistence and survival, they fell far short of providing the positive integration mechanisms that could prevent social disintegration. And this is the issue I turn to next, the reconfiguration of social relations in the area to deal with a rapid and radical social change. I group these patterns under three headings: the retreat to the family, the erosion of social networks, and dynamic attempts at social mobilization. Now, the family was still the most robust institution that my interviewees could rely on. A common response to the crisis was moving back with parents or grandparents. Especially in households with only one member receiving a salary or a pension, this would often stretch to cover everyone under the same roof, the basic needs of everyone under the roof. So really the math of dividing a dwindling pension among more people escaped nobody and could become a source of tension. Manolis, who worked as a carpenter, moved in with his grandparents after not being able to find a job for months. He said, "My grandpa and my grandma can pull through with his 600 euro pension, but we fight a lot. They want me to pay a bit of the electricity bill. They say I live there too, and I have to help. Look, I'm lucky to be able to live with them, but where am I supposed to find the money?" Aided in general by the high rates of home ownership and tenant-friendly eviction laws, the family has really maintained its role as a shock absorber to some degree, at the same time as being severely constrained in the level of support it can provide. The fact that this level of indigence is something that my interviewees had never experienced before or thought they would never experience again came as a powerful shock, compounded by the inability to cushion their children. This shock ties into the second component of the shifts in social connectedness that I've traced. In contrast to the coming together of the family, my respondents overwhelmingly attested to the erosion of social networks, including friendships, extended family, former co-workers. Most of my interviewees linked this to their changed financial situation. Social interactions could become dreaded. You sit around a table and everyone says, this happened to me, this happened to me. Everyone says the same thing. Something happened to all of us. This drowns me. It depresses me. I don't want to hear it, says Katerina, who used to be a municipality worker. In addition, the manifest inability to perform social obligations associated with friendships could become a discouragement from seeking them. As Maria put it, we knew differently. When we go to somebody's home, we have to bring some sweets, something. Now we don't even celebrate birthdays and such things. We've become isolated. We were different. We had friends. My sister-in-law used to come over and would put out some wine and olives, and our night would pass. That's all gone now. We just sit at home, indoors, only, television, or we'll sleep. But sleep is by now a luxury. My husband takes sleeping pills. I walk around the flat. So this pervasive erosion of social ties and the increased strains on the household have limited people's capacity to cope with adversity, as the networks they could rely on in the past no longer exist. So what fills that void, if anything? During my fieldwork, I encountered two dynamic counter-movements to social alienation, and I will trace each in turn. As I mentioned earlier, security considerations did not allow me to conduct fieldwork at the Golden Dawn site in the neighborhood. At the time I was doing my fieldwork, an immigrant was stabbed to death in central Athens, and a Guardian journalist was beat up by Golden Dawn members. It wasn't really the most opportune time for me to be going in with my tape recorder and interviewing people. But their operations were referred to me by a number of interviewees independently, and I will trace shortly what was happening there. Here you can see this ground floor space that they rented. They put metal sheets in front of the windows. In one, they painted the Greek flag, and on another one, their logo. And this was their local chapter. And they provided food to people. Twice a week at minimum, usually more. Here you can see a queue waiting to get food. But access to those kind of services were only open to people who were members of the organization. And this came at a cost. Receiving social assistance from the party was conditional on participation in the party's social activities and participation in the rallies. In a way, for Golden Dawn, there's really no such thing as a free lunch. So those receiving services from the local chapter were either young, usually men, the majority, or completely impoverished people who had developed a portfolio of livelihoods and going from Golden Dawn to a church to another church in order to gather as much food or other resources they needed. So Golden Dawn, in a way, did provide some social resources and material resources to people who turned to it. For example, an unambiguous sense of belonging, some food, some social services. And can really be seen in contrast to the second counter-movement to social alienation that I encountered, which was the Open Assembly of Perama. This was founded in 2011 as well, and quickly expanded its membership and activities. It takes pride in having a non-hierarchical structure. And as they grew, they moved into larger premises here that were funded by donations. They have no statement of principles, but catchwords like fairness, equity, and resistance came up a lot in all of my discussions. Talking to its various members and participating in their meetings, a few key themes emerged that I trace in turn. First, a clear objective was to counter the dependence on charities and focus on bringing out empowering creative forces in the community. This took a few forms. On the one hand, the provision of member-to-member services, training and information. Numerous activities fall under this heading. For example, they had volunteer teachers giving after-school classes to children. Or they had volunteer lawyers having information sessions for people on how to cope with debt or how to manage to claim unemployment benefits from the state, and how to overcome various bureaucratic hurdles. Here you see some pictures. These are two flyers from their actions for children. One, both referred to some kind of theater-like events they held in their center. And here you see a shopping trolley with a banner reading "Solidarity to the basket of the unemployed people," where people could donate some food or whatever. So, on the other hand, the focus on creation and empowerment entailed embedding their actions in an ethos of reciprocity. Now, this was particularly the case for actions that depended on the cooperation and collaboration of others. For example, one interviewee described, "We used to go to the open air market towards closing time and ask them to donate some of the stuff, fruits and vegetables, that they hadn't sold. They did, and many of us would come and help carry things over to our space, where we would redistribute them. But this did not feel right. And then we thought, they're working class people, we're working class people. There must be something we can do for them. And you know, they have these long benches for stuff and umbrellas, and they break sometimes or need repairs. So we thought, we have all of these tools lying around from our previous work. Why don't we put them to good use? So now we help them by repairing whatever we can. It's a bit more equal like this." The second thing that theme that emerged was the attempt to root their actions in the spirit of solidarity, seen in contrast to the prevailing alienation in the area. In a focus group discussion, one informant commented, "The past 20 years of pseudo-affluence, or affluence, depends on one's point of view, made people become private. In the old days, people were close. This was a working-class neighborhood. We used to support each other." Another one jumped in. "You know, what we do here is on the basis of solidarity. And it's not really hard for someone whose access to electricity was cut to enter this logic. If you don't have electricity, you help the guy who does not lose his." Also, third, the focus was on inclusion. Almost everyone from the neighborhood was welcome. There was no application form to join the party, to join the assembly, and newcomers were informed of the criteria by one of the leading figures, which was no fascist, no racist, no Golden Dawn members. Everyone else is welcome, but without carrying their party flags. Membership is really hard to calculate, given that they don't have a membership structure. But there was a two-tier membership. There were the hands-on members who participated in most of the actions, and then there were peripheral members who attended a lot of the social events or turned to the assembly for support ad hoc. And participation to all of their activities were open to all and advertised. Their politics were clearly left-leaning, but everyone I talked to went at pains to explain that they were not affiliated with any political party and did not want to be. One member was clear. "I left my party identity in the drawer. I used to be a communist, with the intention to offer to the community." She continued to say, "At age 58, I had to learn all about direct democracy. It was not like this when I was young and active in the Communist Party, but I believe in this now." When asked about the efficacy of resistance, few of my interviewees had any illusions. A leading figure commented, "I know we cannot change everything, but we can put a brake on some things, change people's conscience. Some people think of how they can get back to 2008. That's not going to happen. What matters is how we can fight to achieve a better future and not a worse one. Things are not going to go back." So the various activities that I've described aim to foster this sense of community and endow people with social, informational, and emotional resources to cope with the crisis. And these counter-movements to the erosion of social ties that I have described are another part of the response against the changing social landscape. And turning to the final heading under which I group responses to the crisis, people I interviewed were in an active process of constructing what I term a new socio-spatial imaginary. This was centered around Perama as a locus of industry, and themselves as hard workers earning a decent living. My interviews suggest that whether as individuals or as groups, people were engaged in this active process of reconstructing imaginaries that highlighted the specificities of the area rather than more general frameworks like national identity. As described earlier, the neighborhood was built up primarily between the 40s and 70s by people working at the port who appropriated the land. The relevance of the area's history is the common struggle against the state by many of my interviewees' parents in order to gain property rights to the land. And in many ways, the current crisis is experienced as yet another struggle against the state. Various respondents independently use words like paradise and land of wonders to describe the neighborhood in the old days. For example, Panos reminisced, Perama was the land of wonders. Lots of work, I tell you. Now you cannot listen to the sound of a hammer if you look for it. What was consistently highlighted was the area as a land of opportunity, and the interviewees' capacity to work hard in tough and often dangerous jobs. The area had one of the highest industrial accident rates in Europe. And my interviewees recognized that this identity was lost in the years of affluence, and were now trying to reconstruct it. Commonly, this happened by looking down on the past two consumption-focused decades, including on themselves engaging in consumption rather than production. And they derived value out of having belonged to this group of hard workers. This process was more explicit in the assembly. They set up an exhibition with old pictures of Perama, had film screenings of black and white movies that were filmed in the area and highlighted the working class nature of the area and the strong social bonds there. Such stimuli did evoke a kind of group dreaming, a collective dreaming of what a different society would look like and how to achieve it. For example, by forming workers' collectives. A lot of people started asking me about Argentina, that they had heard a little bit about workers' collectives, and there was a real excitement to discuss such issues with me. In one photo exhibition in the Central Square in the summer, an old man recognized himself in one of the pictures. Here you can see it's a picture from the 60s and it's on opening roads in the area. So an old man recognized himself in one of the pictures and started crying. And this provided impetus for discussing how social relations had changed over the years. When I was there last year, the assembly was in talks with a nearby monastery to gain access to some of their land for cultivation. And this became again the source of much excitement and evoked further discussions of what a different society would look like. In long discussions in their crowded and rather small space, they engaged again in a form of collective dreaming. The focus was on how to engage in socialized forms of agriculture where everyone would contribute either labor or seeds or livestock or something like that. Articulating these dreams was an active process of intellectual creation in a social context, thereby endowing people with an optimism that wasn't really warranted if one looks at their economic situation. So in other words, this process did confer significant cultural resources to them. So to conclude, in this study I tried to move beyond pointing to the fact that some communities were fundamentally transformed by the crisis and to document how one specific community responded to rapid socioeconomic change. I grouped these responses under three headings: securing survival, reconfiguring social relations, and reconstructing cultural repertoires. In short, I argue that my interviewees have become newly disadvantaged. This is a term that is inspired by the work of Bill Wilson, who wrote an influential book in the 80s called The Truly Disadvantaged. And I use it to refer to people who, until the onset of the crisis, were able to secure a livelihood on the basis of market and welfare state provided resources, and who are now doubly excluded, both from a market-based income and from state-provided benefits. Their resources to cope with adversity have been reduced to a minimum, while their life challenges have been increased to a maximum. So how do we analytically approach these issues? There are two trends in the literature. One is to look at social resilience in the face of crisis. And this literature, pioneered by Peter Hall and Michel Lamont, usually focuses on the achievement of well-being in the face of adversity. On the other hand, anthropological literature, pioneered by Kleinman and others, focuses on the collective trauma to families and communities resulting from different forms of violence, whether they're economic, political, physical, or symbolic. Now, the main problem with these frameworks is that they're constructed with reference to static concepts of resilience or suffering. They're predominantly understood as states of being and can lead to two potential pitfalls in analyzing the social consequences of the crisis. On the one hand, if we look at suffering, the danger is removing human agency altogether and modeling people as powerless victims waiting to be steamrolled by grand forces of capitalism. On the other hand, the resilience literature can romanticize resistance by emphasizing the so-called weapons of the weak in overcoming structures of domination and glorifying what really is survival strategies. So in many ways in this presentation, I've tried to follow a middle ground, which highlights the constraints on people's ability to respond to the new socioeconomic conditions without understanding them as completely powerless. So following Klaus Hofer, I understand the crisis not as an event, but as a mechanism that generates events, and have documented a range of such transformations in the social sphere, but have not really discussed in depth the economic sphere or the political sphere. So what happened to the group I studied was a simultaneous drop in living standards, loss of social status, and a debasement of their symbolic construction of reality. As a result, former wage earners found themselves in a position where they had to struggle for mere survival. They now understood this, their relationship to the state in purely negative terms, as in their view, recently introduced policies, whether it's health reforms or electricity pricing, were directly hampering their ability to cope with heightened life challenges. Now, how these processes play out in different groups depends on a wide range of factors that a study like mine is not really able to uncover. I try to provide a snapshot of one group in one area at one point in time. So we can discuss generalizability of these findings in the Q&A section. But for example, had I chosen to study young people, I anticipate that Golden Dawn would be front and center. And actually, if we look at the success of the early Hitler movement in Germany, it was partly due to the fact they were able to mobilize armies of unemployed men, young unemployed men, who received paramilitary training. And what we know about Golden Dawn suggests several similar patterns. So taking a broader look, these dynamics of exclusion that I have described are not really unique to Greece. The severity and length of recessions in Southern Europe and the levels of unemployment and the degree of welfare state retrenchment do not really provide a basis for very much optimism. A growing proportion of the population is left without a market-based income, without state-provided welfare services, and with social support structures struggling to cope. For example, the question of how much longer the family will still be able to support its members is an open question. Ultimately, what will happen to these people will depend on the political developments in Greece and Southern Europe more broadly. A number of parties, from Syriza to Podemos to the Five Star Movement, claim to have the interests of these people at heart. And it remains really to be seen to what extent such parties become successful and what they will do if they get elected. Thanks a lot.
Alex, thank you very much. I sense there must be quite a few questions from the audience, but as you collect your thoughts and you prepare to notify if your intention to ask a question, let me kick off with a question of my own. You mentioned that the people in the area, they were kind of always saw themselves as fighting against or having the state against them. Although what you showed about participation, opening the roads and stuff, you know, building mm-hmm. those, did not necessarily suggest that. But so, you know, for getting the property rights, and then also today, they consider the state to be against them. So I would say even at the prosperity times, you could think the state was against them, either because the electoral patterns were very much kind of to the left, or because you can think how tax evasion and things may have been higher in areas like Panama. So I want to ask you, if this is true, then how does this square with that narrative, that interpretation that you gave about a new, I'm not very good with the terminology, but a reconstructing imaginaries and, you know, the new kind of cultural interpretation of understanding of where they are. So if always the state was, you know, the enemy or the thing, you know, they were always outside the state, so mm-hmm. how is this a new...
Well, to begin with, tax evasion, among the people I interviewed, and this was a constructed sample, wasn't very high, because all of them held jobs at the port or in the municipality, or the kind of jobs where you can't really hide income even if you want to. So tax evasion was not an issue I encountered very much, per se. And when it comes to their relationship to the state, I think the struggle against the state primarily refers to earlier decades when they were still struggling to get property rights to their land. So up until the 70s or 80s, the fact that this was a PASOK-dominated, so a social democratic-dominated area, suggests that these were part of the people who were very much benefited out of what Andrés Pajandreu did, and that's why they voted by 44% or so for them. But how that ties into these imaginaries that I described, it was about reconstructing something that was long gone, the way I understand it. So for them, even though under PASOK they were doing quite well in comparison, they now realize, many people now realize, by virtue of becoming completely dispossessed, that it was all fake, to one degree or another. And it's really trying to go back to an earlier time in that neighborhood or in that area, where people were really hard workers, where they would have to work in these very dangerous jobs to earn a living, which also overlap with the times when the state was not as friendly to them. So it's really going back to the 70s or 60s rather than going back to the 90s or 80s, or that's the way I understood it, at least.
I enjoyed that very much. It's truly interesting. I've got kind of like two or three questions. The two are interrelated. They have to do with questions of generalability, as you mentioned before. Are there any other areas in Athens or Thessaloniki or urban centers where you can see similar effects of the crisis? And by the same token, can you see similar processes in the UK, for example? Has something equivalent happened in the 80s, for example, when you had newly dispossessed here as well with the deindustrialization, what happened in the north of England or what's going on today to a certain extent? So if you have any idea of how does this compare and whether this is possible in Greece to create this kind of, I would say, percentage of people like in the UK, long-term dependent, long-term unemployed, long-term, a population which is actually marginalized by the fact that they cannot enter the market again, like we see here. And my other question is that what do you make of the concept of the precariat?
Yeah.
Because I've noticed that you didn't use it, and it's quite commonly used to describe those situations.
So the issue of generalizability, if we take the assembly, for example, there are a range of these so-called assemblies. They have different names, but they essentially do the same thing, kind of social groups getting together on a neighborhood basis. And we see them across Athens or Thessaloniki in major cities, basically. Now, I can't really comment on that. I did spend some time in the equivalent assembly in Iliupoli, which is a neighborhood in Athens that's a bit more middle class. So it really varies quite a lot what they do and how they do it. And it depends quite a bit on the class profile of the neighborhood. Because their membership is constricted to people from the neighborhood only, they depend in part on the inputs they get. So Perama versus Iliupoli versus Touba in Thessaloniki probably have quite different concerns. But we do see these issues more broadly. We see these this bubbling up. Mary Kaldor has a book on this called The Bubbling Up of Subterranean Politics. And this does refer to these kind of issues. As far as the UK is concerned, I can't comment extensively. My knowledge of the literature in the UK when it comes to poverty and coping with adversity is really all of it is channeled through the welfare state. It's all about how the welfare state can help people re-enter the labor market. So now I'm thinking very much about the work by Duncan Galley and Cathy Marsh, those kind of early studies of unemployment. And they were really about how can the welfare state ensure that people re-enter the labor market at a job that's somewhat equivalent to their skill set. But I can't really comment extensively about the north of England. Now, the concept of the precariat, that's one good way of putting it. Dispossessed is another by David Harvey. Now, I chose the newly disadvantaged, so the Wilson-inspired term rather than the guy standing or the David Harvey, in part because it carries less baggage. If we look, for example, at the dispossessed, a lot of the work on the dispossessed or in the precariat focuses on spatial aspects of dispossession, about people being evicted and these sort of things, which we didn't really have in Greece. It does happen in Spain. But I tried to find an as neutral term as possible so that people don't project different things onto it. But the dynamic I'm getting at is the double exclusion, both from the welfare state and from the market. And we don't really have that many instances of such experiences in the developed world outside the US. In Europe, most of the literature focuses on the welfare state, whether it's France or Germany or England. In the US, the work of Kathy Eden and others really tries to get to some of the dynamics I'm discussing. But there, the racial component is also very prominent that we don't have in Greece as much.
Can I just follow up that quickly? I was thinking it is interesting that, you know, if you think about the old disadvantages, then they can be described much more easily, I think, as the precariats, because there were also disadvantages at the times where there were sort of channels through which you could find work, and, you know, the welfare, even outside the welfare state, the state was there to provide through informal networks. So then, did you get a sense that these newly disadvantaged are really fragmented from the old disadvantaged? Although you said you didn't speak to people who were unemployed before.
I did encounter people like that, and
because you also mentioned it was very inclusive, all the, you know, the assemblies and
yes,
stuff.
Yes, so I did, of course, I did encounter people like that. What I tried to get, the difference of my interviewees was that for them, the drop was much bigger, the drop in living standards. Those who were really poor before the crisis kept being very poor, in many cases were even worse. But the difference in these people was that they had already developed a kind of portfolio of livelihoods where they knew that they could go to this church where that priest is more friendly to them, or that church, or, you know, move to another, go to another area where they knew that somebody could, you know, support them with food or something along those lines. So they really had a range of ways of coping. And for them, the new situation was slightly worse, but not too much worse. Whereas for my interviewees, the people were really wage earners, right, for many years, who most of them had worked continuously for 15 or 20 years, and now found themselves in a position where they couldn't afford basic necessities. I remember this a woman who started crying in the interview. That happened quite a lot in various of my interviews, because actually quite a few people said that I'm the first person they got to talk to about what was happening to them. So this woman was crying and said that back in the old days, she would throw away food or buy an extra loaf of bread for a beggar on the street. And now she cannot afford to buy two loaves to feed her family. She had two underage children. So it's really the drop in living standards that I'm trying to get at, and that emerged very much out of my interviews.
Yeah, so I found the your discussion of the construction of new imaginaries quite fascinating, and I think very much needed in sociological work that looks at this crisis and their aftermath. I was wondering, you showed us the shifts in the political landscape in the area, which we called both shifts, clear shifts towards the Golden Dawn and clear shifts towards Syriza.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the role of Golden Dawn in the development of social networks and the reconfiguration of social networks. I was wondering, especially because you're talking about this kind of, I don't want to say third way, but this approach that this analytical framework that moves beyond the kind of passive versus voluntaristic, it's all agency, or it's all kind of passive acceptance. So constructing imaginary. So I was wondering how you see the political, the institutionally legitimized political actors, such as Syriza, for example, being part of that process of constructing new imaginaries. Have they, in other words, has the trend, the registered trend towards Syriza as a left-wing alternative of carriers of hope and a new imaginary, if you like, from an institutional perspective, has it had an influence, have you observed that on the ground, on the social construction of, alternative futures or imaginaries? Does this make sense, or...?
You discuss institutionally legitimized actors. Taking a value-free approach for a second, why is Golden Dawn not institutionally legitimized in the sense that...
But the assembly isn't, though, right?
The assembly isn't. I get what you're saying. I think we can look at it in terms of endogenous and exogenous dynamics. The assembly is a bottom-up thing, right? And that was developed within the community for the community. Whereas Golden Dawn or Syriza or whichever party was always exogenous. So it came in order to roll out a range of activities in exchange with the bottom line being that they wanted votes, right? They wanted political support for specific agendas. So that is tied into... and these parties, both Syriza and Golden Dawn, really framed their imaginary of society, if we can put it like that, in terms of at national level. It was always about Greeks or the working class. Whereas when I discuss imaginaries, it's much more specific to the area. It's about us versus whatever else is out there. It's us as working class people, hard workers, and so on. So really embedding it to the neighborhood. I'm not sure if that really gets to the bottom of your question, but...
You made a very interesting sort of mention at one point of the dream that people had of a sort of collective organisation of agriculture. You mentioned seeds and sharing and so on, which sounded very much like a sort of embryonic agricultural cooperative or type of organisation or response. And if you look back at the last sort of 100 crises that have happened in the last 150 years or so in southern Europe and also eastern Europe, you'll find that people have often responded by setting up different types of cooperative organisations, whether agricultural cooperatives or credit cooperatives or whatever. And this is often seen as a sort of third way, or middle way between the state and the market as an alternative. Mm-hmm. And in countries like Spain, Portugal, Italy, there's quite a long sort of experience, track record with those sorts of organisations, and therefore something for people to build on. But as far as I know, in Greece, there has not been that experience or something for people to turn to. So the question is, am I right that there's been no previous sort of experience of that? And secondly, would a sort of comparison across the different countries of that type of response?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't comment very much about the comparative experience other than the trends I know or what you reported. What I found interesting about this was that this was a conversation taking place among people who had never cultivated anything, for that matter, and in a very urban setting. I mean, that land is barren land. It's not that they live next to a valley that they could cultivate and generate a living out of. So I refer to it mostly because of the excitement it generated against all odds. Now, taking a step beyond this community, there has been a very marked pattern of leaving urban centres and moving to the countryside. The population of Athens has decreased by about 200,000 since the onset of the crisis. Thessaloniki has decreased by about 50,000. And many of these people, what we know, because data are very difficult to find, is many people actually go to back to their villages where they can cultivate some land that they inherited from their grandparents or something like that. But I do not really have any evidence, nor am I aware of actual collectives, agricultural collectives. So maybe it happens and has skipped my radar.
Yes, thank you very much. Yes, it was a great presentation. You're obviously one of the few, maybe the only person doing this kind of research. Are you yourself, are you going back to Panama to do some follow-ups, etc.?
It's not currently planned. Yeah. I did spend 5 months there. And this is basically my snapshot of that period. I really think that this type of research is a type of research that needs more comparative work. I mean, tracing a community over time is important, but looking at the differences between different communities, so doing that kind of work in more middle-class areas or working-class areas elsewhere is, I think, a fruitful way of going about it, but that's not what I will be doing in the coming months.
Thanks. One question here, and then the question for the other.
I just wondered, actually.
So you talked about this kind of countervailing sort of dynamic between Golden Dawn and these sort of non-aligned but broadly left solidarity community assemblies. I was wondering, what did you get? I know this isn't specifically what you were looking at, but did you get a sense of what makes the difference? Like, what pushes people one way or the other in a way that seems consistent with the fact that a greater number of people flock to Golden Dawn in the youth sect, as opposed to the sect that you were looking at?
Yeah, well, I mean, if I were to generalize, I'd say experience of past mobilization is a very good predictor of joining these kind of bottom-up direct democracy kind of movements. Golden Dawn really capitalized on young men basically. That was their main source of support. There was, there were very, again, I mean, I'm going out on a limb because I didn't spend much time among them, but they were referred to by many of my interviewees. Very few women among them, other than extremely poor women or men who received services from a range of sources. And I think, you know, what happened in the assembly is refers to the couple of quotes that I gave on people being communists in the past or being PASOK supporters in the past and really active. And when I say in the past, I mean primarily in the 70s and 80s. And then when they started, when their living conditions improved quite a lot, they became less active in politics. Perhaps because they didn't have too much to fight for anymore, their living conditions were improving. And now they're reconstructing at age 50 or 60 things that they used to do when they were 18 or 20. I think this this quote by this woman that she had to discover direct democracy at age 58 is quite gets to it, in the sense that she was used to a very different kind of decision-making process. And now, because the crisis has affected them that much, basically, such kind of responses is what they've turned to. And I want to separate this from actually making a point about whether these responses are efficient, whether they translate into actual outcomes, because most often they don't.
Yes.
My question was really very similar.
Okay.
Thanks. Then we can take your question.
I just wondered, if you're not pursuing this, what's next on the agenda?
The IMF is next on the agenda, taking on the IMF. And exciting work on migrant health that we're doing with Filipon Ladovsky, who's here at LSE and in the room. That's...
Yes.
Thank you. There are one common coping strategy for unemployed people in countries like Spain and Latvia has been migration. Mm-hmm. And another one has been to participate in a shadow economy.
Mm-hmm.
Are these things that affect Greece and your town?
So the migration element that you mentioned is a key limitation to my work. And so far as the people who migrate, by definition, leave the people I can catch in my sample. So if they've left, I can't really capture that. I didn't really get most of the people I interviewed, exactly because of my criteria for selecting them, were not mobile. They were not mobile, whether because they had children, or because they were older, or because they didn't speak foreign languages so that they could move abroad. I mean, many of these people were port workers who were 45 or 50 years old and had a family. So it was much harder for them to move. I did get stories of people moving to the countryside, but these were stories from others, basically referring to, oh yes, they had a little house in the village and went to live there. Now, when it comes to the shadow economy, it depends on how you define it. If you think of the shadow economy as people doing odd jobs off the, you know, without notifying the tax services, yes, that did happen. Whenever somebody could get any kind of job, whether that would be cleaning some building or painting a flat or something like that, they would do these kind of 30-euro generating jobs, but there were very few and far in between. I mean, maybe this, for example, this carpenter I interviewed, who moved in with his grandparents. He got a small gig to paint something for 35 euros, and that was 2 days work, and then didn't get anything for about 2 or 2.5 weeks. So, you know, it's not really... It didn't come across as something that, oh, people have shifted from formal employment to shadow economy. It was more shifting from formal employment to nearly nothing and trying to live, to survive on the basis of family structures or these other resources I traced.
I think there was another question at the back.
Alex, great talk. My question is, I think, about the about kinship as mm-hmm. a resource, as a cultural resource for rethinking these practices that you've so elegantly documented. And what's interesting, I think there's a point about generalizability here as well, because if you think about the retrenchment of the state across different constituencies and a rise of kinship across the social, at either end really of the social spectrum, think about how important inherited wealth is in Piketty's story
mm-hmm.
versus the family as a kind of buffer at the other end of the social spectrum like your example. And in what way then does kinship qua patria then slide into a cultural resource for a kind of either a potentially fascist group, right? A broader kind of family that then is not the actual kinship family, but kinship as a kind of narrative, as a cultural resource for a broader right-wing movement, or kinship as a ideological construct for a more left-wing brotherhood of comparison. So, in some sense, kinship seems to be available more and more as a cultural resource for reimagining things across the political spectrum. What way A, is that happening at all, and B, how is it spinning either right or left?
Yeah, well, to begin with, that is definitely happening, and this is a great question. Now, you know, whose reconstruction wins depends on a range of things, right? This is fun. Okay, so whether... I guess depends ultimately on how they manage to integrate people into this new way of envisioning things. And if we discuss Golden Dawn, I'd say they've been very successful at getting young people integrated. And young men in particular. And that explains their continued success. I mean, at the moment, even though half of the party leadership or most of the party leadership is in prison in the polls, they still command above 6% or so. And that's after killings, after having beat up a range of people and so on. So I guess it depends on... how appealing the new frame is. But again, this ties into my previous comment about comparative work, because I haven't really done comparative work. I'm not quite sure I could do justice to your question.
Alex, can I ask you also, you mentioned that the like the political parties or the kind of the mainstream didn't have really so much influence, access, and legitimization, if you want to. You didn't say anything about unions, trade unions,
mm-hmm.
And this being a working class area, mm-hmm. there would obviously be a strong union representation, but also the access to local unions and so forth.
Yeah.
So were they not involved, or you didn't look at...
Well, they weren't involved, and people actually harbored very... negative feelings against the unions. They felt that the unions betrayed them. To some degree, it was a vicious circle, because if I leave their narrative and look at it from the outside, many of them abandoned unions while things were going well, and basically at the moment when they needed them most, the unions weren't there. They also felt that... unions have become an insider organizations, and really harbored very negative feelings about them, but at the same time longed for a different kind of unionization approach. One example of how important they thought unions were had to do with this very large investment that happened in Piraeus, where, and a few people refer to it independently, where Costco, a Chinese company, bought part of the port of Piraeus and hired a number of people. Now, what Costco did was hire a lot of these people through these specialized vehicles that can employ up to 20 people at a time. Because if you have 21 people, they can unionize. So, you know, with examples like that, people were really feeling that what they wanted was a strong union to protect their class interests and not allow Costco or other companies to find shortcuts around unionization laws. But overwhelmingly, they felt let down. In my experience, and I did interview a lot of people, many of them had abandoned unions before the crisis. So in that regard, maybe it's not extremely surprising that the unions didn't really rush to their rescue.
But they also didn't ask to, you know, they didn't seek to reinstate the links with the unions.
No.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can I ask also my last question? Because I thought somebody would pick that up, that point, and nobody did. So you mentioned, I think, actually in a couple of occasions, this idea that people during the years of affluence and people became more private, partly what you said about sort of the unionization also links exactly to that. But I thought in both occasions where you mentioned that, it was more of a kind of a complaint that the neighborhood is not like how it used to be in the 50s and 60s. But there was there, did you explore it, or there was some that came up whether people becoming private was also part of the problem and the crisis and the so the quality of the welfare state and things like that. So was there some attribution to, you know, that people becoming private or the way the period of affluence worked actually contributed to the problems and the crisis? Yes. Yeah.
Yes, this was very much the case. This was part of their diagnosis of the problem, of what happened to them, was that over a number of years, about 20 years for most of them, they broadly talked, when we talk about years of affluence, most people talked about the period between the late 80s and the onset of the crisis. So what they generally referred to was really abandoning the community and taking an active interest in consuming and participating in this brand new Greece. It's a European country, and you know, we can afford a lot more, we can spend more money was coming their way through various channels. And that's exactly what they realized, they diagnosed as part of the problem, was that we shouldn't really be doing that. They had no illusions about what was actually happening anymore. And I guess it's the drop in living standards that really pushes forward with such a realization, and reflected in how fast they abandoned PASOK, that arguably was the main party that would have helped those people in the past. Syriza was actually below national average. Its power in the neighborhood was below national average prior to the crisis. So it was really about trying to reconstruct what was lost. And the discussions that they were having were all about production. How can we become productive members of society again, rather than unemployed or having services, having skills that are underutilized? And this was really the narrative, and that translated when they discussed workers' collectives, or with the workers' collectives, as you saw in one of the pictures, this was an area with a lot of shipyards, many of which had closed down. And it was really, and that's what many people wanted to discuss with me, is can we take them over, you know, can you look into the legal framework, how can we take over the shipyards and start running them ourselves? So it was really about trying to reconstruct something that was long gone, gone long before the crisis started.
Thanks. We have a few more minutes for questions, so we take perhaps the last.
Sorry, this is a rather broad question, but what do you think is the most promising avenue to start catalyzing recovery? Is it looking at certain subgroups of the population? Is it focusing on welfare reform or health reform? Or, like, you had that quote that said, you know, this is the new reality. I keep wanting to go back to 2008, but I need to accept that this is it, what it is. So how would you suggest to catalyze recovery?
Yes, well, I mean, this talk is rather pessimistic. I think it came out. And I'm not very optimistic in general. And when we discuss recovery, recovery for whom and at what rate, right? I think that for the people that I studied, recovery will come last because they have the kind of services that are not valued by the market at the moment. I don't think they will be valued at the market for the very near future. So what many of them, especially those who are 55 or 60, what they have to look forward is possibly getting some kind of minuscule state pension when they reach 65 or 67. And they are the kind of people who drop out the rhetoric of recovery if you listen to what the Prime Minister keeps talking about innovation economies and, you know, vague things like that. But that is not really anything that will translate into changed economic circumstances for these kind of people, the people who have skills that are no longer validated by the market. And in a way, this ties into broader shifts, right? The fact that low-skilled workers are very much affected is the same whether we're looking at Greece or England or the UK or Spain or elsewhere. So that ties to the recovery part. The welfare state part, that's the serious argument, right? Is that the welfare state needs to take into account these people. If I am to quote Francis Castells, the welfare state scholar, long lines of unemployed people are the core business of the welfare state, right? These are the people for whom the welfare state should be there. But at the same time, these are the people whom the welfare state has abandoned completely. And in my view, the only source of change will be political change. Now, this is not to say that it will be changed for the better or worse. But if past experience is any guide for future experience, then, you know, I don't think that we will see anything different happening in terms of welfare provision. You see some kind of policies starting to be implemented, but they're always more on the rhetorical level rather than on the actual, rather than things that make a difference on the ground. I mean, if I'm to give you an example, the Minister of Health announced that he had ring-fenced funds for pharmaceuticals for the uninsured population, who are now more than 2 million people. And what he really meant was that he had ring-fenced funds so that the uninsured population could buy medicine at the same price as the insured population. And if you link that to the fact that co-payments have gone up, essentially you're asking unemployed and uninsured people to pay these 51 euros or amounts for their drugs that they never had anyway. So it's always at the rhetorical level is, you know, how can we portray that we're expanding the welfare state there when in fact we're not really doing anything? That's not very optimistic.
But that would still be an expansion, nevertheless. Okay, Will has the last question.
You mentioned Northern England, or somebody mentioned Northern England, and the collapse of industry that took place, like the steel industry in the 70s and the coal industry in the 80s and so on. Maybe I've got the decades wrong, but sort of a long time ago. And I mean, what happened there was a sort of massive intervention by the state in the form of retraining and restructuring and so on. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that, you know, the shipbuilding industry isn't going to be providing incomes anytime soon. So this is a question of doing something else, yeah, different, and therefore restructuring and retraining and so on. But obviously, with fiscal, yeah, consolidation, this Greek state doesn't have the money for that. So therefore, one would sort of look to Europe, you know, to do that. The European Investment Bank, for example, is there any discussion of that in Greece? Is there any sign that that Europe is sort of going to step in anytime soon as the state which is going to restructure this way?
Yes, well, you raise a very good point. The Greek welfare state never did these sort of things. It's not the success of the German welfare state is in part because of the corporate structure of the economy that really links business, labor unions, and government together, and in designing training packages. So really trying to link people's skills to what is required in the economy. And that's why it's considered by many very successful. Now, the Greek welfare state never did that. And it has become so hollowed out over recent years that I really doubt they have the capacity to do it, even if they wanted to at the moment, which ties into your point about external support, whether it's from the European Investment Bank or elsewhere. Now, I've had some experience on such issues collaborating with the WHO, and on the basis of my experience on that, so working with the WHO on welfare state reforms in Greece, that has made me even less optimistic. So seeing essentially I don't know whether it's an inability to change or just a lack of interest, but you also see these discussions with this so-called task force on Greece that's supposed to provide technical assistance. I'd welcome if anyone has any positive cases of the task force actually translating into changed practices, but I have yet to see any concrete outcomes out of that task force. So, but it's also a toothless institution, right? Unlike the Troika that has its bailout conditionality, task force and such soft forms of assistance essentially depend on on how a minister or senior bureaucrat sees that fitting into his or her agenda. I know these institutions are interested, including the European Investment Bank. I just don't know whether it has any actual effect.
I think this is an extremely positive note. Alexi, thank you very much for your presentation, your extensive discussion and comments. And thanks, everybody, for attending the seminar. Be reminded about the event tomorrow, 6:30, and in 2 weeks' time again here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.